Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Quintessential Listening Poetry. I'm here tonight with our very special guest, Indran Amathanayagam. Indran, are you there?
Yes. Thank you very much, Michael, for inviting me.
You're more than welcome. I'm glad you're here. Let me ask you a question. What is poetry?
Poetry is a kind of word music, you know. It's musical speech. It's also a kind of dance word music, you know. For me, poetry is both physical steps, dancing, and it's auditory. It's musical. It's a rhythm that goes through the body, through the fingers, as you write. And so, I don't separate poems from music, nor from dance. They all form part of the same enterprise, the same response to the world, or to inspiration.
Well, let me ask this question. Why do you think poetry is important?
Well, you know, Marianne Moore once said that something like that, we die for what is not in poetry. I mean, poetry is comes from that. The word itself means making metaphors, the Greek root of the word poetry. You're a human being.
Yes.
Just an ordinary person, but you're blessed with a divine kind of energy, a spirit that courses through you. That's called inspiration. You're inspired. It literally moves into you and you produce your poem. And so when you're writing the poem, you're communicating not only with your fellow human beings, but you're passing an energy through into your words that comes from beyond you, that's bigger than you, and that's that inspiration. You can call it God who inspires you. You can call it some overwhelming emotion, because there are many, many compelling reasons to write, and today, every day, and when you have one of these compelling reasons thudding into you, your response, your tu respuesta as a poet is to write that poem, to write that, convert that inspiration, that thudding inspiration into musical speech, into words on paper, words heard out loud.
Well, you know, I have a compelling reason to ask you to share a piece of your work. Please share a piece of your work.
I would be happy to do that. I'm going back in time now to my very first book, which was called The Elephants of Reckoning. The poem is called Kiss. Kissing your lips, I try to forget roses or the fruit of Palmyra trees, sweet and strong. Tongue lolling upon tongue, heart beating against heart beating. These are my words signifying our human bodies, which poetry does not capture. The absolute desire I have to kiss your lips on this hot and sunny afternoon. I do not know how much longer I can walk about the garden kissing roses, or perambulate the toddy tavern of my dreams, where black faces and white toddy mix in black and white memories of Jaffna, Sri Lanka, my Tamil country, far away on an island across the sea. Far away and far away, the Palmyra fruit and your lips. To drink toddy now, to kiss your rosy lips now, to uproot the roses in my garden and offer them upon my tongue now, to fly to Sri Lanka and grab the last fruit on the tree before history throws the Tamils into the sea, as it said it will do. Before all this and everything else, before the apocalypse, I do so sincerely wish, though my words may not fit, to rest my head in your hair and kiss your lips. Thank you.
That was beautiful. You know, I've always wanted to visit Sri Lanka. What sparked your initial love of poetry?
Well, you know, when I was a boy, I grew up in that marvelous island known then as Ceylon. I grew up with elephants. I grew up with leopard. I grew up with wild birds and wild boar. It was a jungle as much as it was a city, the island of Ceylon in my youth. Mm-hmm. And I remember going hunting with my grandfather into the bush. And, you know, they say the hunters were the first environmentalists, you know, and you learn a lot about the natural world. But you are hunting, you are killing, and then bringing the meat back and sharing it with your family and your friends. But as a boy, I went on those trips, and those trips in the jungle marked me and marked my poetry forever. But then I left that island, that paradise, went to England, to another island, to London, to the island of England, and lived there for 6 years. And then again, another movement to Hawaii, again an island, the island of Oahu, where I went to high school. And suddenly in Hawaii, I was seeing tropical fruits and flowers, and I was seeing mangoes, I was on the beach, and I was reminded of my original island, that island of Ceylon. And I think in that reminder, that strong reminder, and my being an adolescent and turning, changing, being a bit solitary, I found in poetry a solution, a solace, a way to understand, to interpret the world, and a way to remember that paradise lost. You know, we all have our paradises inside of ourselves, and we tend to be nostalgic about the past often. I was too. But then I realized that in that past, there were, you know, the snake was slithering about, and Cain was killing Abel, and all kinds of blood thuggery was taking place in that paradise. And that's what eventually, as I began to be aware of where I indeed came from, where man is only savage to man, I realized that I had a story to tell, not only about this beautiful paradise, this island where we lived in generously with each other, but also this terrible history of conflict, of ethnic conflict, of political conflict, of conflict over land. And eventually I wrote a book called Uncivil War, about that civil war in Sri Lanka, which I call an uncivil war. I suppose all wars are uncivil. And anyway, so the poetry came from those contrasts, being again confronted with an island, a tropical island, but in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, far removed from Sri Lanka, far removed from England, in a tiny island before internet, before you know, some of our modern tricks of communication. I had to face that reality of that tiny space and write. And I chose poetry as my way of interpreting the world. Yeah.
What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Some of the predominant themes, I would say migration, exile, you know, we are constantly moving. Our bodies move all the time. I mean, our blood circulates in our veins. The earth itself is moving constantly around the sun. There is no such thing as static stasis, really. So the migrant is a fundamental theme for me. And the migrant with a wound on his head is also fundamental. The story of Cain and Abel fits nicely for me. I mean, I could never understand why a brother would kill his brother.
Yes.
Or a sister. It's just, you know, this is just, it's such a fundamental travesty. And yet, the farmer and the, and then there's the conflict between the farmer and the herder, you know, the Shepherdsons and the Grangerfords later on in Mark Twain's writing. I mean, you have these different choices and these conflicts and blood spilling, and then the mark of Cain. Cain wandering the earth, he cannot wipe that mark off. He is condemned to wander the earth with that mark of the crime he committed. So there's a powerful negative energy that is exorcised in my poetry. The negative, you could call it the energy that leads to war, that kills your brother, that causes environmental harm. I mean, for example, in a lot of my poetry, I write about disappearance of forest, of birds, of elephants. When I was a kid, Ceylon, you could see an elephant almost on every street corner, theoretically. Nowadays, you could go to the island and not see an elephant except in the elephant orphanage or in the zoo. So you can imagine what that must feel like for you who knew an earlier time when there was a friendlier, more easygoing relationship between human beings and other creatures, in this case, the elephants. So we have to restore that balance. The earth is imbalanced, and that's why we have these incredibly hot summers in Washington and in Europe, everywhere. We have Greenland lakes sprouting where there should be ice. Why?
Yes.
This is human generated climate travesty, climate injury. We're committing a kind of a murder to our ecosystem, just as Abel was killed by Cain. We are killing our eco brother, our eco sister, our earth and our ocean. So we have to step back, and poetry has a role to play in that conscientization of all of us, you know. Just what is a poem? It's a celebration of life, ultimately. It's a celebration of relationship to God. It's a celebration of love. Love your neighbor. What a basic principle to live your life by. If we could just adopt that principle in our daily lives and in our weekly lives and in our yearly lives and in all our actions, if we could live truly to that very powerful idea and let that idea inform our poems and our friendships, we can stop this violence, this hatred. And we have to take practical steps also to stop the hatred. I mean, such as eliminating these websites where these hateful manifestos can be placed. I mean, I'm talking to you just after two enormous tragedies in the United States, in Dayton and in El Paso. And, you know, I find myself sad, like all of us, thinking about those ordinary people going to the Walmart, doing their Saturday shopping, and finding themselves shot, killed by this monster. Well, you know, we don't have to accept that. We have to respond, and as poets, we respond And as politicians, we can respond. As lawmakers, we can respond.
Well, let me
ask
you a question.
I have a poem. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. Have you had an opportunity to write a piece about what has happened in terms of the tragedies in El Paso?
Finally, at the end of the day yesterday, I wrote something. I called it The Spared, and I'd be happy to recite it for you.
Yes, please.
It's a very raw piece. It's just, it goes like this. The Spared. I've been wrestling with the devil throughout the day. No news of one friend. Another wrote to express solidarity with all who read his post. My fingers are stuttering. I cannot summon the energy, concentrate, focus on some theme other than this paralyzing sadness. We have all passed through El Paso, or will go there. It is both border and resting place, a quaint, friendly town, proud of supporting a symphony, as well as baseball teams, and all sorts of leisure abandoned today by people who would prefer to nurse wounds at home or go to mass. The churches are full, yes, but in my homeland 3 months ago, parishioners were bombed. A politician used to speak about points of light. Today, citizens of Ciudad Juarez are lighting candles in solidarity with cousins in El Paso. But I don't feel the heat or see the light. One friend has yet to write. I'm hoping that the long silence between us means simply that she has not seen the message. I will send this poem next and wake up tomorrow and scour the papers for lists of the dead. I'm hoping that she and her son survived. Why focus on one missing person? Why focus on hate speech drumming my ears that will not let me sleep? Why do those cursed expletives burn through my American dream? I will not go back to where I came from. I am here, and today my cousins in El Paso and in Dayton have been murdered. We will judge their killers and the killed. They have not died in vain. They have not died for this poem. They have not died, but one remains unaccounted for. Please write. Please say that the nightmare rode by, spared you and us this time. That's it. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, you know.
Extremely powerful.
Yeah, it just comes out of life. I mean, we're all wondering, you know, who among us was in that store, or who
yes.
among us was in those bar in outside of in Dayton. It's just incredibly scary, and yet we have to find our strength again, just mm-hmm. like after 9/11, we have to come together, build our community back, and find a way to deal with this extremism, this hatred that and stop, do what we can to protect ourselves, and to the next steps are for our legislators to take.
Yes,
the laws they can pass, and the security practices that our police and us and our protectors can engage in order to restore order, right?
I agree 100%. Let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
All right. Thank you. Mommy. No, not yet. Great.
name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Indran. Our telephone number is 646-787-1631 if you'd like to ask Indran a question. Indran, please share another piece of your work.
I would love to. Let me try something a little different. I'm going to read one of my poems in Spanish, and then I'll read a translation of it into English. This is from a book called Ventana Azul, which means blue window. And I'll read it first in Spanish. Poem is called Viaje, or Trip. Estamos de viaje, cada uno por su cuenta, tú hacia la montaña, yo al mar, tú con nuevos amigos y con tiempo para reflexionar, yo a ver a mi hija, el fruto del pasado, y a unos amigos todavía en este lado del mar. No sé qué provecho sacar del contraste, montaña, mar, amigos nuevos, una hija alta y bella, casi una adolescente a punto de despegar. ¿A dónde? ¿A una nueva ciudad? ¿Al futuro que le espera otra vez en el padre? A mí no me gusta lo impermanente y darme cuenta del límite de la costa. ¿Qué opciones me quedan? ¿No regresar? ¿No dar algún consejo a este ser vivo al que ayudé a caminar? Guardar el silencio cuando cada memoria quiere hablar. And now the version in English, thanks to Jennifer Rathburn, the translator, Trip. We are on a trip, each one on our own. You towards the mountain, I to the sea. You with new friends and time to reflect, I to see my daughter, fruit of the past, and a few friends still on this side of the sea. I don't know how to take advantage of the contrast, mountain, sea, new friends, a tall and beautiful daughter, almost an adolescent, ready to take off. Where to? A new city? To a future that awaits her again without her father? I don't like the impermanent and realize the limit of the coast. What options are left for me? Not return? Not give some advice to this living being whom I helped teach how to walk? Keep silent when every memory wants to speak. Thank you.
Wow, another touching piece. Tell us about your process. Is it pen and paper, computer, notebooks? How do you write?
Well, it's been pen and paper, but it's often now writing notes in a phone and then transcribing them onto the computer or writing directly onto the laptop. But I have notebooks, and I do occasionally write initial drafts in them. I'm a little nostalgic for that. I think I'll go back to notebooks and pen and paper, in a sense, because there's something about the physical act of writing out the word that gives some kind of texture to the word and strength to the word and flexibility to the word. I don't know. It's something very instinctive when you actually write out the word as opposed to type it out or... I don't use dictaphones. I don't speak the poem into and record it and then transcribe it. I hardly ever do that. So my usual method is, yes, writing on the computer, laptop or on the phone. But I am nostalgic for returning to the page, returning to the notebook.
Do you have a special place that you write?
Not really. I write all the time sometimes, you know, when I'm inspired.
Right.
And so I write at home early morning, often, or late at night. I write sometimes during the day at work, which I shouldn't. But sometimes I'm overwhelmed by the poem, and I can't help but write at least some notes down and then finish it later. So I've been lucky in a sense to be blessed with to be a fairly fecund imagination and writing quite often. it can be a little crazy. I mean, you write obsessively, and I mean, it's not a competition. There's no rule that says you should write one poem a day or six poems a day or zero a day. But keep the, it's a physical exercise as well as a mental exercise as well as an emotional exercise, all of those things. And I think finally it's a liberating exercise. So when I write something like the poem I wrote late last night after the killings in El Paso and Dayton, it's a sad story, but it's also a cathartic experience. You know, I write the poem and I feel somehow a little better having written it down, having being able to put the emotion into musical speech of some kind or phrases that perhaps will speak to a reader. I mean, I sent the poem afterwards to some friends. I sent it to a magazine too. I'll wait to hear if they publish it. But the point being that I don't believe the poem should end on the page.
Yes.
It's essential for me to share the poem, whether it's with friends through email or reading it out at a reading and of course publishing. But it's a community business. Once the poem is written, it becomes part of the community. You know, the word polis, politics, comes from polis, which means community business. And for me, poetry is very much community business, you know. So you write the poem if you're a poet. If you're a painter, you paint. You different ways to respond to reality. But we have
well,
to
question
respond.
For you. Question, what makes a poem good?
You know, the words good and bad are very broad and imprecise terms. I suppose a poem that is good is one that moves you somehow to action or makes you cry or weep or laugh, you know. It results in some kind of an emotional, intellectual reaction and almost a physical reaction when you're laughing your head off, you know, because of something. I mean, I remember the great poet, Chilean poet Nicanor Parra, when I first met him, he drew a little drawing for me, and he put at the bottom of the drawing, "Cada uno fracasa a su manera." Everybody fails in his own way. I thought that was hilarious, you know. I mean, everybody's going to fail in your own way. So I thought,
agree.
I just was. So that's Nicanor, and so I think that's what I mean by a good poem. I guess a poem that moves you, that gets you thinking about deep or even light things, you know, that takes you away from the sad reality and gets you dancing, you know. I mean, I remember when I was writing the poems about the civil war in Sri Lanka, I also wrote poems about the World Cup in 2010. They were kind of the football poems, the soccer poems were kind of antidote to the war poems, you know.
I understand.
To each his own. But there is something I think that we can say is works as a poem and something that doesn't work. I mean, for example, if you look at a phrase, you can say the phrase is fresh or lively or it moves you, or you can say it's flat or it's dull or it doesn't, or it's hackneyed, you know? You can make those kinds of judgments in revising your work. And I think that's why it's helpful to share your work and get people to give you their opinions, and then it becomes a collective exercise in shaping the poem, but it's a good exercise, you know. I mean,
so you belong to a community of writers?
I do. I mean, you know, almost had Groucho Marx line about a club that if you would have me as a member, then no. But I mean, I belong to a community of writers. You know, I mean, even if they don't want me, I'm there. You know, I'm in your face. I'm writing every day, and you can't deny me. You know, I mean, and you know, sometimes people try. I mean, they say, you know, Indran, I mean, please don't send me a poem every day. You know, just hold off a bit. But no, we all belong to a very broad community of writers in different languages, you know, around the whole earth is a community of writers. But yes, we have our groups. I think groups are good. They strengthen bonds. And so here in the D.C. area, I'm part of the D.C. Poets. And I actually work with an organization called D.C. Alt, District of Columbia Association of Literary Translators. And we celebrate literary translating and organizing events to celebrate the art of translating, which is something we essential. I mean, I read Neruda first in the translations of Pablo of Alistair Reed. Without those translations, I would not have, until I learned Spanish later, I would not have been able to appreciate the artistry of that great poet. So translation is critical. I do a series here called Poetry at the Port at the Port-au-Prince restaurant in Silver Spring every once a month. The next one is on August 26th at 7 p.m. And it's a celebration of the word. It's spoken word. It's an open mic. It's also featured poets. And it's a lot of fun, and it's a community exercise, you know. People are coming every month sharing their work. It's a good feeling when you get something going and people like it and they like to share their work. And one of the nice things about that series is we don't say no to any language. So if you bring a poem and you want to read it in Chinese, you read it in Chinese, you know? I mean,
yes.
Because we can appreciate the music even if we don't necessarily understand the meaning, you know, the words.
Well, do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
I think I was meant to be a poet. Well, I don't know about being meant to be a poet, but I did have poetry in my family. My dad was a poet, a very fine poet, and I had a great uncle who was a poet and an editor. His name was Tambi Mutu, and he edited Poetry London during the Second World War in London. So I had those models in the family, and my dad, Gaya Mithanagam. So when I started writing poetry, I couldn't be denied in a sense. My dad couldn't say, oh, go off and be a doctor or, you know, which is what most Tamil families would like their children to be, doctors or lawyers or accountants. But in my case, we had the model of a poet in the family. So it was easier for me to choose that path. Now, I can't say I've made my living from poetry, but without poetry, I don't think my life would have much meaning. I've devoted a lot. I've learned a lot from poetry. I hope I can keep giving back through poetry to the world is what my purpose is.
Well, please share another of your works.
I would love to. Perhaps I'll go to my latest book. This is Coconuts on Mars. And here's a poem my mother dedicated to my mother who is with me here in Washington. And it's a tough poem because it was a period when she fell ill but she has recovered magnificently. The poem is called Delirious Together. My mum's gone batty, apparently, visiting the thrift shop every day, buying Wedgwood china, silver-plated photo albums, bed sheets, chairs, eyeing a new table for the back, all to be understood, but she wants to give what she buys to her children, already twice grown with kids of their own approaching college. Is this a second childhood, the giver who refuses time? Her brain is unscathed, but the behavior will not conform. Damn you, living within your means. I can walk, I can take the bus, and I can get a fellow to bring the stuff back in his truck. Mummy, one kid calls you cunning, another obstinate, rock hard. But I felt you say I love you very much the day I left in every corpuscle of blood. False alarm too, that departure. I will return, all of us will, from Ceylon, Canada, England, the US of America. Damn exile, damn money, your riotous laugh. Run up the credit cards until the levy breaks. But society, order, the cleaning service will be in charge now. And we will channel the flood, keep blood flowing in the skin. Mommy, you are, you were a powerful, natural God. 79 years of fight. We doff our hats before your force, your life. We join your laughter now. Thank you. It's very
another
special
beautiful
to read that
piece.
Me. Thank you.
It reminds me of my own mom. She just turned 80. So I understand.
Exactly. She's my mom is now 83. And yeah, exactly. That's right. That's right. And you know, if there's something about this new book, Coconuts on Mars, I mean, the title is a kind of whimsy, you know, because I talked earlier about migration and how that's so fundamental to my poetry. Well, here I'm sort of thinking about what the next migration will be, right?
Oh,
so
yes.
Coconut will that have traveled through the earth, through the oceans. You know, you can find palm trees in Cornwall in England. You can find coconut trees everywhere. And then now the thing about coconuts going to Mars. So that's what led to the title, Coconuts on Mars.
Is your work available on Amazon.com?
It is. Quite a number of the books are available there. You can also look for them at IndranMX.com, my website. Some of the harder books to find, you could write to me through my website, and I can make some arrangement to get you, if there are any copies available of certain books. It's IndranMX.com. And right. But Amazon has a number of books, like this new one, Coconuts on Mars, is available actually on the Amazon India site, because it was published in India, but it's available through through the publisher Paperwall, and they don't charge to send the book abroad, so it's a pretty good deal.
Right.
And then I have books I write in English, in French, in Spanish, in Creole, and in Portuguese, but I have published only books in French, Spanish, and English. But anyway, it's been a great thrill, the run, you know, and I'm just delighted that I'm of sound mind and body still and able to write and share.
All right. Well, share another piece, please.
All right. How about this one? It's called Living Will, and it's from the new book as well. One day I will sit down with my soul and write that I have loved every bird that flew, every monkey on the branch, every elephant charging through the grass. I will say I love you as much as the baby gecko scampering past my foot, the snake rustling under the wood cut and stacked in my yard. I will say I have loved every creature, every song, every turn in the road, and I will be lying with my eyes open and my eyes closed. I am not God. I am not even the dog loyal to his master who misses him blind, like his daughter in Lima, which I call at night until the next time we meet in dreams, via chat, cheek to cheek, remembering always that in paradise there are no trains or roads or seas or death, no going away, no arriving, doors and garden open, souls who come and go smiling, and all the angels, all birds, all dolphins, all men and women in song dancing, and why not reciting the Song of Solomon, the epic poems, the love songs that consoled when we set off on the roads, hopped on trains and aeroplanes, got caught in traffic in our head, said goodbye before saying hello. Did I know you down there? You were the greengrocer I walked past going to school in London. Oh, my dear, how beautiful you are, Pauline, with ripe red hair, who shared the religion prize with me at St. Vincent's on Blandford Street. But you may be alive still, and I'm not ready to meet my maker, to be plucked from the cycle of rebirth. Not yet. I have poems to compose, children to raise, earth to cultivate. Come back later, angel. I have my will to revise. Thank you.
Wow.
Wow, living will.
I like that.
I haven't written that will yet.
You know, I'm sure that our listening audience would like to hear another poem, so please, please share another.
All right. This is a kind of a quirky one, and it's called By All Means a Whale. You know, we all know about the great American literary obsession with Moby Dick, right? By All
Yes.
Means a Whale. The humped-backed whale has swum from beyond Cape Cod to frolic with her pup in the warm, cool waters off Samana. The migratory reach of birds, fish, and mammals is the subject of a million doctoral theses. But no one has yet to explain pure chance, coincidence, why I happened to see this particular mother and child on Saturday morning. The fact that I bought an excursion on a whale-watching tour, that I was guaranteed a whale or another tour free of charge, are mere helpers of fate. The boat could have sprung a leak, the car take me to port run out of gas. My imagination might have surprised me moving from observed reality to dream and fantasy. I did put Moby Dick in my bag, just in case. Thank you.
Well, on that note, we'll take a brief break and we'll be right back.
All right. Thank you.
Indran, question for you.
Yeah.
Writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write?
Well, I mean, staying silent is certainly not an option for me. There's been too much going on that needs poetry. You know, to reply as a reply. I don't necessarily write with a message in mind. I think the message has to somehow be part and parcel of the image, kind of naturally in the gift of the line. So let's say the message is reduce your carbon footprint, reduce your ecological imprint on the planet. I mean, I don't just say reduce your carbon footprint in a poem, but I somehow want to show that through an image or through a story that I tell in the poem, you know. But I don't necessarily think of a message in advance. For example, last night when I wrote this poem about the killings in El Paso, I did not know when I started the poem how the poem would turn out or what my message would be. I just felt this overwhelming need to break through the sadness that I was feeling and convert it into words, into musical words. And also I wanted to communicate with my friends in everywhere, and including El Paso. And so the way I did that was through writing the poem. So I think the reasons one writes are both the same for everybody, and each person may have their own particular argument as to why they write. But I think it's an overwhelming compulsion, you know, that seizes you. I remember once sitting in a library at college, at university, and I was possessed by a spirit, literally. I was shaking at the desk. You know, if somebody looked at me, they must have been thinking that I was having some kind of a fit or some kind of a, because I was shaking with the energy that needed to be put, translated into words. And I was writing while I was shaking. It's that kind of thing, an electric energy, a spiritual divine energy that courses through you and you write. Now, one talks about professional writers, amateur writers. I mean, you know, yes, you can sit down and organize your day and keep yourself, let's say, 2 hours or 3 hours of a day just for writing. And even if you don't get that energy coursing through you, you can still produce something. But it's a discipline too. Yes, it is a discipline, and it's work. And you can organize, but you don't. You need that. It's not only that. It's discipline mixed with that inspiration. And you can train your body to be susceptible to the inspiration, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. I find I have so much email coming in, or so many things that news items that I want to read and so on. That takes time. So I have to become very disciplined about organizing my morning when I look through what's out there, to go through it in a way that is satisfying to me, and yet then clear the desk, so to speak, or clear the screen, and the screen is blank, and then I write. And I'm swimming in paradise there. I'm swinging in sweet waters there when I get to that stage, you know.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, poets tend to have favorite poets that they visit often. Can you suggest some authors that readers might enjoy checking out?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there are some great authors, great poets from so many centuries, you know. I love in English Yeats's poetry, especially the poems of the Second Coming, poems like Easter 1916, 1919, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, and then this lovely poem at the end of his life called Politics. How can I, that girl standing there, my attention fix on Spanish, on Roman, on Russian politics? That's how it begins. And it's a short little poem that really says, you know, all of this life spent on politics, and it's nothing to love. You know, it's nothing before beauty. It's nothing before that simple joy in seeing and feeling love. Well,
yes.
So Yeats is there. I would love to recommend Kavafi, the Greek poet, and Nazım Hikmet, Hikmet, a great poet from Turkey. I've read both of them in English. Of course, their native languages were Greek and Turkish. You can read them in English or in French if you read French. Wonderful poets. Neruda, especially the Book of Questions, the 20 love poems, the Captain's Verses. For me, these are residents, Extravagaria. These are all great books of Neruda's. And then Borges is always a very interesting poet, as well as short story writer. Rosario Castellanos, a Mexican poet, a woman poet, also a diplomat. I think she's very good, very interesting. Sylvia Plath. I think a number of these poets people know. Adrian Rich. But it's good to go back to them, you know, if you haven't read them in a while. And then read the new poets as well. I mean, poetry is always in dialogue with its past, you know. So when I write a poem, William Butler Yeats comes and sits down next to me, you know, even though he's long dead, right? Or Neruda comes by to have a coffee, you know. It's like, so they're
nice.
Always living with me. But
that's very
but
nice.
But you got to talk to the new poets too. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm just a reader of what's past. I'm also trying to keep in touch with what's going on. It's not easy. There's so much being written, so much to read, but
yes,
it's a good thing to keep up if you can, the contemporary world.
Well, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? What emerges from you?
From my poetry, what emerges naturally is a kind of music, you know, word music that is pleasing to the ear and to the heart and to the memory, you know. If you can console with your words, if you can heal with your words, if you can make someone a little lighter of heart or lighten that load somehow, I think your poem has done a good job, you know. So if some of my poems lighten the load for the reader, if some of them help that reader get up and do a little jig or a dance, you know, I'm happy, you know. And I think that, I mean, it's not for me to say, but I'm hoping that that's what's happening out there, you know, when
yes.
people are reading these poems. Yeah.
Well, please share another. Please share another.
All right. You know what I'll do is I'm going to I'll recite a poem I'll take this one. It's called Homage to Managua. You know, I've been interested in politics and, of course, all my life too, and one of the great one of those rebellions against the nasty dictator Somoza was the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua. Of course,
yes.
Much has changed, and the current day Nicaragua is run by a dictator, unfortunately, who at one time was a hero. But at that time, in the early 80s, right after the revolution, there was still a lot of hope and sort of inspiration by that. And a friend of mine went to Nicaragua, and so I wrote this poem called Homage to Managua, dated May 23rd, 1985. What are you doing down in Nicaragua? Have you drunk coffee yet at the Cafe Buena Vista? Have you met Cardinal? A woman I know is so intrigued by your visit. What about his lover, she said. Doesn't she care about his proximity to bombs, Contras, Sandinistas, long lines of women after bread? Would you live within an embargo, she asked knowingly, as I sipped coffee in my West Side room and thought of the train that took her recent love away. Nothing more, not bread or tea, fear of the Yankee. Your grandmother said you reminded her of the boys that went to Spain. Is there still Spain and a civil war? Catalonia, Neruda, Garcia Lorca. Tell me, what are you doing down in Nicaragua? I have not traveled in years. I no longer know black or white. Naive, yes, both is evil, true, and the right wars, Jaffna, Palestine. So I ask you again, what are you doing down in Nicaragua? To observe, you said, to read and write. And keep your hands off, perhaps. When you left that early Sunday morning, shortly after dawn, I imagined hair blown back and dreams falling like flowers off an unadorned tree, waiting on Broadway for a taxi, belongings sent off to London, carrying a few clothes, notebooks, shoes, a few too many socks. But you could not think of everything, a hat, a wallet of single dollar bills to live like a king and look and practice Spanish, rest your head in some dark loping hair. A good contrast to the Twin Towers, you said, to see Nicaragua before you left the Americas, to walk in the blessing of morning with the fisherman and cobbler, preacher, drinker, market women. Tell me, what are you doing down in Nicaragua? And what have you seen? You know, thank you. When I read this poem now, I'm haunted by the lines, a good contrast to the Twin Towers, you
yes.
said.
Yes, that stood out to me too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, as I remember when I said goodbye to this friend in New York City back in 1985. And at that time, you would never have thought those twin towers would ever come tumbling down, right?
No.
I mean, it's just amazing. And some of the names here, like Botha, he was the president of South Africa at the time, the apartheid president. But, you know, it's a political poem in that sense, because it makes those references to political figures and war. But it's essentially a poem about innocence, you know, that innocent idea of going off to join the revolution, you know, and doing some a young man or young woman's idealism, you know. Poems come from many sources, but they do believe, I do believe that poetry makes something happen. W.H. Auden, also a great poet, he wrote somewhere in one of these poems in memory of W.V.H., poetry makes nothing happen. It exists in the valley of its saying, a way of happening, a mouth. I've always railed against that idea, thinking that indeed poetry does make something happen. At least makes you cry or laugh or feels relieved, you know. So it has some value.
Yes, I understand. One other question. Some poets are also active in other creative activities. What are some of your favorite non-poetry or literature activities?
Well, I love theater. I love the theater. I used to write reviews of plays
when
I lived in New York. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I remember reviewing Mambo Mouth, John Leguizamo's Mambo Mouth, when he was first doing that back in the 80s. Yeah, and I wrote a lovely review, and he wrote me a card thanking me for his review. Anyway, that was a long time back, but I love the theater. So that would be, if I had to choose one other activity, I would go to plays and spend a lot of time in the theater. Then I love music, of course. I mean, I have a strange relationship to popular music. I mean, I've played music. I did an album with some Haitian musicians in Creole. It's called Rancont Doute. You can listen to it on you know, the music stores like Spotify or Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. I love it. We recorded it in a studio in Port-au-Prince. The music is lovely, and the words are simple Creole poems, love poems, nostalgic poems. But I used to be in a punk band many years ago.
A punk band too? Oh, wow.
Yeah, but then there was this big gap in the middle because, you know, I'll tell you the little story. When I was doing the band, that was the most amazing closeness, you know, with the other band members, the writing the songs together, the two lead guitarists and myself in particular. We were very close. And then the band broke up for reasons that I was not happy about. I mean, I was a lead singer, and I felt like they wanted to do cover music and they didn't want to do the original songs anymore.
Right.
But it was very hurtful, you know, I was very sensitive. I was like 19 years old and I had this. So when the band broke up, then I really then concentrated on this solitary road, you know, the poetry road, you know, writing. But whenever I see like Bob Dylan, when he does, puts a band together like in Rolling Thunder Review and brings Allen Ginsberg on board and they're performing together. And I just think that's heaven, you know. So there's a nice, I mean, you can't do everything. There's a value to writing by yourself and producing solid, strong, moving poems, you know. But there's also value to combining those with musicians and dancers and performing together. And so if you can somehow do both, that I think would be the ideal.
Well, please share, we're at the end of the program. Please share one more of your works.
Okay. I'll recite something from memory, which it's called You Must Love. And it goes like this. You must love the land when you leave to build your house on the sea. Love what's lost, the mango tree burning in the garden, the curious noose of the familiar coat of arms. Love the ball turning strong, spinning in a dark, faraway land. Love the tongue you'll never again speak, that wrapped you and bled you and dried up some every day on the other side of the sea. Thank you.
You've been a wonderful guest.
Thank you.
You know, when people hear your work, they usually want more, I'm sure. What's next for you as a poet?
Well, you know, I'm working on a manuscript which is going to come out next year from Hanging Loose Press in the U.S. I'm excited about that. It's got a tentative title. I'm still unsure which of two titles I'll go with, but it has to do with memory. It has to do with American memory in some form or another. And so that's going to come out next year. And I have another manuscript too, which is with a different press. I'm waiting to hear. So I've got work sort of finished that's waiting for a decision. And then I'm also a friend of mine, a musician friend, a Haitian friend who's based in Mexico City, and he has a project. We have a project to do a kind of a music video of a song based on words I wrote. They Have Not Died in Vain, it's called. And so we're working on that, even though I'm here and he's there, but we'll put that together and see what we can do, what will come of that next, you know. So those are the, I've also got a translation project that I need to start working on, a Spanish poet named Beatrice Rousseau that I'm going to start working on translating her poems. So I've got lots of things going on. It's keeping busy. I'm also editing Belkwe Poetry Journal. I'm just starting to take over that editing job. And so keep an eye out for Beltway Poetry Journal. I and Venus Thrash will be editing upcoming issues. So looking forward to that as well.
Well, I'd like to thank you again for being a guest on the show. And I'd like to say good night to our listening audience. Good night, everybody. Take care.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Take care.